Hitler's War by David Irving. Clutching at Straws. By the spring of 1943, the Axis alliance was a myth, and Hitler knew it. From the decoded messages shown to him, it was clear that both the Hungarian and Romanian governments had emissaries in neutral capitals who were sounding the Western enemy on the prospects of peace. Finland was searching for a way out of the war, Sweden for a way into it, on the Allied side. Hitler, who had just personally instructed his new envoy to Stockholm that his sole purpose must be to keep Sweden neutral, now contemplated more drastic measures. After one Berghof conference, he detained Jodl and a handful of trusted advisors and instructed them to draft outline plans for a lightning invasion of Sweden, should the need arise. Romania's Marshal Antonescu, invited to the Berghof on April 12th, accepted Hitler's reproaches with a fatalistic air. When Hitler read the Forschungsamt records of incriminating telephone conversations proving the disloyalty of Romanian ministers and their clandestine negotiations with the enemy, the marshal made a convincing display of indignation. Hitler gave the Hungarian regent a rather rougher ride when he came 4 days later. Horthy supported his prime minister Calais to the hilt and denied that Hungary was in contact with the enemy. Quote, "We are all in the same boat," Hitler warned. "If anybody jumps ship now, he drowns." End quote. Nor was the language very delicate that he and Ribbentrop used to prod Horthy into taking a sterner line over the 800,000 Hungarian Jews. For months, Germany had pressed for them to be turned over to the appropriate German agencies for deportation to, quote-unquote, reservations in the East, arguing that they were potential rumor mongers, purveyors of defeatism, saboteurs, agents of the enemy's secret service, and contact men for quote-unquote international Jewry, now embattled against Germany. On April 16th, the interpreter recorded Ribbentrop as advising Horthy that he would have to confine his Jews to concentration camps if he were not to liquidate them. There was no third way. Germany was today standing with her morale firm, echoed Hitler, because she had removed the Jews. Those still remaining would soon also have, quote-unquote, vanished to the east. He did not mind being excoriated for his Jewish policies, if these brought him tranquility. The enemy Jews, he reminded Horthy, were behind the bombing deaths of countless women and children in Germany. Horthy apologized that he had done all he decently could against the Jews. Quote, "But one can't very well murder them or bump them off somehow," he protested. End quote for that guy. Hitler retorted, quote, "There is no need for that either. Just as in Slovakia, however, they must be isolated in remote camps where they could not infect healthy society." Excuse me. As for the talk of murdering Jews, Hitler pointed out, quote, "Only one person murders the Jew who starts wars and by his influence gives them their anti-civilian, anti-woman, and anti-children character," end quote. The Jews could be put to work in the mines, Ribbentrop agreed. They could not be allowed to run around, quote-unquote, scot-free. Since Horthy seemed unconvinced, on the 17th, Hitler stepped up the rhetoric. Poland, he said, would have been an object lesson. He related to Horthy how Polish Jews who refused to work were shot or just wasted away. Using his favorite analogy, he argued that Jews must be treated like tuberculosis bacilli. Quote, "That is not cruel, if one remembered that even innocent creatures like hares and deer had to be killed so that no harm was caused. Why should one spare the beasts who wanted to bring us Bolshevism? Nations that did not fight off the Jews went to rack and ruin," end quote. In Hitler's warning to Horthy that the quote-unquote Jewish Bolsheviks would liquidate all Europe's intelligentsia, we can identify the influence of a propaganda windfall about which Goebbels had just telephoned him. Strange frozen mounds had been pointed out to German soldiers in the Katyn forest near Smolensk. In February, by March 1943, they had thawed and been opened to reveal the remains of 12,000 Polish army officers. The diaries and letters found on the corpses were last dated April 1940, when the region was in Russian hands. They had all been shot expertly in the nape of the neck. Hitler approved Goebbels' suggestion that Katyn should be linked in the public's mind with the Jewish question. Nor was Hitler minded to treat even the non-Jewish of Stalin's peoples with kid gloves. Throughout the spring of 1943, a squabble raged between Alfred Rosenberg, the endlessly verbose minister of the Eastern Territories, and Gauleiter Erich Koch, Reich Commissar of the Ukraine. Rosenberg, supported by Ribbentrop, Zietzler, and Goebbels, wanted to win the subject people's support in the fight against Stalin, and he complained that Koch's brutal methods and Pasha lifestyle were incompatible with this. At Christmas, he had sent a special plane to Rostov to collect 200 pounds of caviar, yet Hitler, Bormann, and more circumspectly, Himmler, defended Koch. Rosenberg might theorize about the future of cultural life of the Ukraine, but Koch's harsh duty was to squeeze every ton of grain and every slave laborer he could out of the region. The idea of harnessing Russians voluntarily to the war against Stalin was chimera, said Hitler. Quote, I have always felt there are only a handful of men who can really keep their heads in a major crisis, without being waylaid by some phantom hope or other. The saying that drowning men clutch at straws is only too true, end quote. When Ribbentrop identified himself to General Vlasov's idea for a Russian army of liberation, Hitler rapped his knuckles. There will, quote, there will be no such political operations. They will only result in our people fraternizing with the Russians, end quote. Field Marshals Kluge and Kuchler were also rebuffed when they supported the Vlasov project. Millions of leaflets dropped over enemy lines announced that the Wehrmacht was fighting only Stalin and not the Russian people, and they spoke of a quote-unquote national committee in Smolensk as though it were the Russian government being groomed for the post-Stalin era. To Hitler, this idea was madness, as he angrily told Zietzler to let the Ukrainians set up their own government. Would be tantamount to throwing away the Nazis' entire war aim. The Russians would start off as a satellite state, such as Poland had been in World War I, and Germany would end up confronting an entirely independent state all over again. On May 19th, Hitler brought Rosenberg and Koch face to face. Rosenberg firmly repeated that Koch's policies were supplying the enemy with thousands of partisans. Koch justified his methods. Hitler adjudged that both were right, though Koch was righter. As for the partisan argument, if Rosenberg were right, there would be fewest partisans where the, quote, particularly crafty generals, unquote, spoke in the most honeyed tones. This was not the case, nor could slave labor be procured except by Koch's methods. Quote, only feeble-minded generals imagine we can win any manpower by blandishments, unquote. As for Koch's executions in the Ukraine, challenged Hitler, quote, how many of our compatriots are losing their lives in air raids right here at home? End quote. Hitler laid down that in the future neither Koch nor Rosenberg was to employ foreigners as advisors. Quote, if they work against their own country, they are devoid of character. If they work for it, they are useless as advisors to us. End quote. The military aspects of the Vlasov Russian Army project were analyzed in a heated session between Hitler, Keitel, and Zietzler some weeks later. Hitler did not object to employing Russian volunteers in non-combatant duties, but he would not approve of the Vlasov project beyond its propaganda value. Vlasov himself would be needed only for his photograph on the leaflets. Keitel accordingly ruled that no national committee was to be set up. The Führer would permit Vlasov's leaflets only on condition that the German agencies realized that nobody must take them seriously. Hitler had given his general staff a free hand in devising a plan for Citadel. A modest victory in Russia would inspire neutrals and half-hearted allies alike. It would stabilize the front for the rest of 1943, long enough for him to release armored divisions to thwart any enemy molestation of Italy or the Balkans. In addition, the home economy badly needed the slave labor that Citadel would harvest in its wake. Zietzler's final proposal was that the objective, an enemy salient near Kursk, should be excised in a classic pincer attack by the 9th Army from the north and the 4th Panzer Army from the south, their spearheads meeting just east of Kursk. Zietzler drafted a pompously worded operational order. Quote, The victory at Kursk must shine as a beacon to the whole world, end quote. And Hitler signed it on April 15th. It made grim provision for the rounding up and smooth westward dispatch of the hundreds of thousands of able-bodied Russians expected to fall into the German net. Quote, Citadel, it's the name of the operation, was set to begin on the 3rd of May. Once this much had been settled, Zietzler flew back to his headquarters in East Prussia, but a few days later he received a telephone call from Hitler. The Führer had thought Citadel over and now felt it would be better to abandon the idea of a pincer attack, which was so obvious that the enemy would be certain to be ready and waiting for it, and instead combine the assault forces of Army Groups South and Center on one frontal thrust, thus splitting the enemy's massed strength in two. Zietzler would not hear of it, saying that redeploying the two armies would inflict a crippling delay. He made a special flight to Berchtesgaden on April 21st to prove it. Hitler yielded. Zietzler had proved right at Stalingrad, while his own sureness of touch, his strategic instinct, had failed him then. General Model, commander of the Ninth Army, had originally asked for 2 days to punch through the Russian defenses, but late in April he raised this estimate to 3 days. Kluge pointed out that with 227 tanks and 120 assault guns, the Ninth Army was stronger than ever before. But Model claimed he still needed 100 more tanks. Zietzler agreed to rush 50 from the west and 20 more Tigers and 40 assault guns, but the three-day estimate worried Hitler. 3 days of uninterrupted battle against an experienced enemy would result in the massacre of the assault troops. Quote, when Model before... Wait a minute, did I get that right? No. Okay. Quote, when Model told me before Citadel that he'd need 3 days, Hitler said a year later, that's when I got cold feet, end quote. He asked Model to fly to the Berghof. On April 27th, the wiry, dark-haired general was standing before him in the Great Hall. His aerial photographs appeared to confirm that claim that 12-mile-deep Russian fortifications had to be overcome before the Ninth Army could advance on Kursk. Hitler postponed the start of Citadel to May 5th. On April 29th, he ordered a further postponement to the 9th to give the armies a few more days to stockpile tanks and guns. Out of a, quote, few more days, unquote, grew weeks, then months. General Guderian, who began attending the war conferences on May 2nd in his capacity as inspector of panzer troops, gave Hitler his own impression of increased tank availability if Citadel could be delayed long enough. At present, he said the Tiger was plagued by gear and steering faults, and the advanced Panther tanks' production had repeatedly broken down. But Guderian assured Hitler that during May, two battalions of each of the different tank types, Panthers, Ferdinands, Tigers, and Hornets, would be activated. The existing tanks on the front would be reinforced with armored aprons against anti-tank shells. In addition, tank output itself was increased. 939 tanks in April 1st, 140 in May. Oh, wait, 939 tanks in April, 1,140 in May, 1,005 in June, and 1,071 in July. In short, suggested Guderian, it was well worth holding up Citadel for a bit. Hitler, his own mind already made up for an even longer postponement, summoned his leading generals to Munich for a 3-hour conference on May 4th. Jeschenik rendered a contemporary description to Richthofen, which threw a piquant sidelight on personalities around the Führer. Quote, on April 27th, General Model declared he was not strong enough and would probably get bogged down or take too long. The Führer took a view that the attack must be punched through without fail in shortest time possible. Early in May, General Guderian offered to furnish enough tank units within 6 weeks to guarantee this. The Führer thus decided on a postponement of 6 weeks. To get the blessing of all sides on this decision, he called a conference on May 4th with Field Marshals von Kluge and von Manstein. At first, they agreed on a postponement, but then they heard that the Führer had already made up his mind to that effect. They spoke out for an immediate opening of the attack, apparently in order to avoid the odium of being blamed for the postponement themselves. Jeschenik, Richthofen, and Zietzler all opposed any further delay, arguing that time would operate solely in favor of the Russians. Nonetheless, Hitler now postponed Citadel to mid-June. End quote. Another factor now bore on his decisions. Imminent defeat in Tunisia. Starved of ammunition, food, and fuel, General von Arnim's quarter of 1,000,000 troops had fought a stubborn rearguard action in its ever-shrinking bridgehead. By the end of April, he had only 70 tanks left and was distilling what fuel he could from low-grade wines and liquors. Hitler dispatched General Varlamont to Rome to renew pressure on the quivering Italian navy. Quote, "The only moral act is to fight and win this war," he was to tell the Italians. "What is immoral is to lose, and then scuttle your ships without having fought," end quote. The appeal availed Hitler not. The Italian navy stayed in harbor. On May 6th, overcoming Arnim's defense of the mountain passes, the British First Army broke through to Tunis. 2 days later, however, Keitel wrote, quote, "The Führer and Duce are determined to continue the fight in Tunisia as long as possible," end quote. Varlamont returned with comforting news about Mussolini's health and offered his assessment that provided the Duce kept a tight rein on events, the coming loss of Tunis need not spell disaster within Italy. Hitler was not so sure. Quote, "The Duce and the Fascist Party are resolved to stand by Germany through thick and thin," he told his staff at noon. However, "a section of the officer corps, more at the top, fewer lower down, is inclined to make peace already. Certain influential circles are capable of treachery," end quote. He asked Field Marshal Rommel to return from his convalescent leave to see him. On May 6th, Hitler turned his back on the Mediterranean and returned by train to Berlin. Victor Lutze, who had succeeded Rom as SA Chief of Staff 9 years earlier, had just died in an Autobahn accident, and Hitler intended to participate in the next day's state funeral. It was a good funeral. Afterward, he addressed the Gauleiters on the meaning of the present war. It had begun, he said, as a fight between bourgeois and revolutionary states, in which the former had been easily overthrown. Now, however, they were facing in the east a Weltanschauung state like their own, its Jewish Bolshevist ideology permeating its army with a zeal and spirit which only his own SS divisions could match. This was why he, Hitler, had decided that, quote, "the Jews must be thrown out of Europe," end quote. He had come to believe, he continued, that in his great pre-war purges, Stalin had not ruined the Red Army after all. Quite the contrary. The introduction of political commissars had moreover vastly increased the Soviet army's effectiveness. The Russian solidarity behind Stalin was complete. He had no church elements to restrain him as Hitler had in Germany. The Führer often feared, he said, that the Herrenvolk could not forever maintain their superiority. Genghis Khan's hordes had penetrated far into the heart of Europe without Germandom having possessed the strength to hold them back. However, Speer's gigantic tank program would ensure victory in the east, while Dönitz's U-boats kept the Jewish-fostered warmongers of the west at bay. Hitler told the Gauleiters that Stalin had lost over 13 million troops since Barbarossa had started. The summer offensive would be carried forward by dependable German troops alone. Eventually, he promised Germany would dominate all Europe. Talking things over with Goebbels that day, May 9th, Hitler ruled out any idea of emulating the Japanese practice of putting enemy bomber crews on trial. With hundreds of thousands of his own troops falling into enemy hands now, Hitler had no choice. He was heartily sick of this war by now. He yearned to take off his uniform and become a human being once more. He was no less sick of his generals, calling them liars, traitors, and anti-Nazi reactionaries to boot. Goebbels felt that his star was rising. Though heading north again, Hitler had not turned his back on Mussolini. He had never forgotten the Duce's benevolence over Austria in 1938. Quote, "I told him then, quote, I shall never forget you for this. I shall never forget you for this," unquote. "And I never shall," end quote. Hitler admonished his less forgiving staff. He worried far more that the treacherous royalist generals would play Italy into the enemy's hands. This was why he had recalled Rommel. Rommel should command Hitler's troops in Italy when the time came. Rommel flew into Berlin on May 9th and reported to Hitler at 1 p.m., looking fit and well. Hitler kept the ambitious field marshal on tenterhooks. Rommel wrote in his diary, quote, "Afterward, I attended the war conference. No special job as yet. Field Marshal Keitel hinted at my utilization in Italy with the Duce if things should turn sticky there. End quote. The next day, he recorded, I stressed to both the Führer, he recorded, quote, I stressed to both the Führer and Goebbels the meager fighting quality of the Italians and their reluctance to fight, end quote. On the 12th, Hitler released the news that Rommel had been in Germany since March, when he had awarded him the nation's highest medal. At 6 p.m. that evening, Hitler and his staff flew back to his East Prussian headquarters. Perhaps it was a blind attempt to deceive the enemy into believing that Citadel was imminent. He had no fear of an enemy invasion in the West as yet. No, he knew that the Mediterranean was still the most dangerous theater. On May 8th, an adjutant had announced at the war conference, a startling Abwehr scoop. The corpse of an Allied officer found floating off the Spanish coast had yielded sealed envelopes bearing ostensibly genuine letters from the British War Office and Lord Mountbatten addressed to Admiral Sir Andrew Cunningham and General Dwight D. Eisenhower. Two invasion operations were to be mounted. These indicated one in the western Mediterranean and one in the Peloponnese. These would be covered by dummy invasions of Sicily and the Dodecanese, respectively. Admiral Canaris fell hook, line, and sinker for their contents. Hitler was less gullible, and at the end of the war conference spoke his thoughts out loud to Jodl's staff officer. Quote, Christian, couldn't this be a corpse they have deliberately played into our hands? And there's an asterisk related to that. That's also the end of the quote. The conference stenographer, the late Ludwig Krieger, a close aide of the famous intelligence chief Colonel Nikolai in World War I, recalled the scene vividly. The corpse was indeed a macabre ploy of the British Secret Service. Man, Hitler was sharp. And back up. There was no way of knowing. Both Zietzler's intelligence staff and Canaris ruled out the possibility, and for the next month, the Peloponnese and Sardinia, presumed to be the target of the real assault in the western Mediterranean, attracted most of Hitler's attention. Albert Speer and his principal arms barons came to see him at the Wolf's Lair on May 13th. Hitler bestowed a rare award, the quote-unquote doctor-taught ring, on the munitions minister for his reorganization of the armaments industry. His reorganization of the armaments industry had yielded amazing results. Germany was turning out six times as much heavy ammunition as in 1941, and three times as many guns. Between February and May, heavy tank production had doubled, testifying to the indomitable spirit of the workers despite the air raids. To Goebbels, Speer commented that the Führer looked worn out with worry. It was the anxiety over Italy. What use indeed were the new weapons that Speer demonstrated within the headquarters compound the next day? The mighty 100-ton Mouse tank, the new assault guns, and the deadly bazooka, still called Pusherer. If Italy changes sides, if the enemy landed in the Balkans, and if the Romanian oil fields were reduced to ruins. The fighting in Tunis was now over. The Africa Corps' last brave radio emission had arrived signed by its last commander, General Hans Kramer. Quote, ammunition spent, arms and equipment destroyed. The Africa Corps has fought till it can fight no more, as ordered. End quote. 100,000 of Hitler's finest troops were being marched into British and American captivity. Some 150,000 Italians had been taken prisoner. Hitler offered Mussolini five divisions to restore the blood to Italy's anemic arteries. The Duce's reply, obviously drafted by the devious General Ambrosio, Keitel's counterpart, stated that the three German divisions left as a backlog of the transport movements to Tunisia were quite enough, but he wanted 300 tanks, 50 anti-aircraft batteries, and hundreds of fighter aircraft. Admiral Dönitz stated that the Italians expected the British to invade Sicily next. Forgetting his earlier suspicions, Hitler replied that the letters on the British corpse indicated that the target would be Sardinia. Dönitz said that he had tried to impress on the Italians that if they did not employ every available ship, big and small, to pump troops and stores into Sardinia, Sicily, and Corsica now, the dismal story of North Africa would be repeated all over again. Mussolini had weakly accepted this. Jonas quoted Mussolini as saying that the British press was bragging that the capture of Sicily would release 2 million tons of shipping presently obliged to detour around the Cape. Hitler irritably interrupted, quote, "And then our fine submarines must sink them," end quote. Quote, "And on top of that," continued Dönitz, "we are coming up to our worst U-boat crisis since the enemy has new detecting gear, which makes submarine warfare impossible for the first time," end quote. Suddenly, they were losing over 15 U-boats a month. That's no good. Quote, "The losses are too high," exclaimed Hitler. "We can't go on like this," end quote. His insomnia returned. The next 2 weeks in Italy would be crucial. After the noon conference on May 15th, Hitler made a two-hour secret speech to his generals, including Rommel, on the dangerous situation left by the defeat in North Africa. It was so important that It was so important that the note taken by one officer present, Captain Wolf Junge, is quoted here at length. Quote, "The enemy's victory in Africa has not only opened up the east-west passage through the Mediterranean for him, but released 18 to 20 divisions and considerable air and naval forces. They will also exploit the new situation for a political offensive designed to use bluster and blandishments to persuade Germany's weak allies to defect. Quite apart from the military position, this is particularly dangerous in Italy and Hungary. Bulgaria and Romania can be regarded as secure. In Italy, we can rely only on the Duce. There are strong fears that he may be got rid of or neutralized in some way. The royal family, all leading members of the officer corps, the clergy, the Jews, and broad sectors of civil service are hostile or negative toward us. The Duce is now marshaling his fascist guard about him, but the real power is in the hands of the others. Moreover, he is uncertain of himself in military affairs and has to rely on his hostile or incompetent generals, Ambrosio, as is evident from the incomprehensible reply, at least as coming from the Duce, turning down or evading the Führer's offer of troops. In the present situation, a neutral Italy would not be bad at all, but it could not be neutral now. It would defect voluntarily or under pressure to the enemy camp. Italy in enemy hands, is the second front in Europe we must avoid at all costs. It would lay open the western flank of the Balkans, too. Our main purpose now must be to prevent a second front in Europe. Quote, "Europe must be defended in its outfield. We cannot allow a second front to emerge on Reich's frontiers," unquote. It is for this objective that we may have to make sacrifices everywhere. "It is good that we have not yet attacked in the East Citadel, and still have forces available there, because the decision has been taken to act as soon as a crisis breaks out in Italy. To this end, of the 18 mobile divisions available in the East, 8 armored and 4 infantry divisions will have to be rushed to Italy to get a firm grip on her and defend her against the Anglo-Americans, or throw them out again. No resistance of note is expected from the Italians, according to Rommel. Collaboration of the fascist political forces is hoped for. At the same time, Hungary will be occupied. The consequences on Eastern Front will be defensive evacuation of the Oral Bend, acceptance of risk in the Donetsk region. If worse comes to worst, even withdrawal in the north to the Luga line. Zietzler demanded that the bridgehead on the Kuban should also be given up, but the Führer did not express an opinion on that. Zietzler was instructed to work out a timetable for the troop movements from Russia to Italy. The next one or two weeks are crucial. Every week is vital to us, because after about 8 weeks, the newly activated Stalingrad divisions in the west will become operational, which would obviate the need to raid the Eastern Front for divisions. Thus, the main points of the Führer's remarks." End quote. It was certainly a remarkable speech, quite apart from the first hint at enforced German occupations of Italy and Hungary. It destroys the myth that Hitler always refused to abandon territory voluntarily in Russia when it was strategically necessary. When British newspapers, week after week, mocked the German soldiers for surrendering in Tunisia, Ribbentrop begged the Führer to publish the war diaries, proving how heroically they had fought there against impossible odds. Hitler's stubborn refusal was telephoned by Huell back to Ribbentrop. Quote, "We have to be clear that we have suffered a painful defeat in Africa. If you have taken a knock, you mustn't try to talk your way out of it or pretty things up. You will soon end up like the Italians, who make a veritable saga of every defeat they suffer until the whole world laughs at them. There is only one thing to do at times like this. Hold your tongue and prepare to counterattack. Once the counterattack is delivered, all talk of any insufficiency in German soldiers vanishes. Stalingrad is an example. The stories that the German division's morale was collapsing around the moment we struck back hard at the Russians again... Wait a minute. Stalingrad is an example. The stories that the German division's morale was collapsing stopped the moment we struck back hard at the Russians again at Kharkov." End quote. Pretty good point. On May 18th, Hitler ordered Rommel to set up the skeleton staff of a new army group for what was to be, after all, the military occupation of Italy. The operation, codenamed Alaric, was so secret that Hitler declined even to sign the OKW's draft directive. Quote, "This time we've got to be fanatically careful with bits of paper," he said. Unquote. Initially, Rommel's worry was that the Alpine fortifications being hastily completed by the Italians against the Reich frontier might be manned, especially on the Brenner Pass, to keep German divisions out, thus deliberately letting Italy fall into the enemy's hands. Rarely can two ostensibly allied armies have contemplated each other with such veiled mistrust. Zeitzler had calculated for Hitler that the first reinforcements could be flooding from the Russian front into Italy within 10 days of any trouble there. Every 2 days that would then bring a fresh infantry division, spearheaded by 3 SS armored divisions, the troops with the closest ideological ties to the fascist leaders. A speech by Mussolini's foreign minister Bastianini on May 20th, convinced the Führer that the dirty work was afoot. Quote, "We must be on our guard, like a spider in its web. Thank God I've a nose for things like this, so I usually get wind of anything long before it breaks out." End quote. How far Admiral Canaris warned of the treason in Italy is uncertain, but Himmler's officials left Hitler in no doubt. The Italian 6th Army, based on Sicily, was now commanded by General Roada of Balkan, ill repute. Quote-unquote, "crafty," exclaimed Hitler on hearing Roada's name. Quote, "He is the Fuchsia of the fascist revolution, a spy totally devoid of character. A spy is what he is." End quote. Curiously enough, the German military attaché reports from Rome spoke only in the highest terms of both Roada and Ambrosio. But this may have been because one of Canaris's assistants, Colonel Emil Helferich, was attached to the attaché's staff. God, train wreck. With Citadel still delayed at 1 p.m. on May 21st, 1943, Hitler flew from East Prussia down to Berchtesgaden after a brief treatment session with his personal surgeon, Dr. Karl Brandt. 10 days earlier, a fresh electrocardiogram had revealed no improvement on the rapid progressive coronary sclerosis affecting his heart vessels. Marshal Antonescu recommended to him a Viennese dietitian, Frau Marlene von Exner. Young, attractive, and good-natured, she soon shared the Führer's table with the other female headquarters staff. She brought back memories of old Vienna to her new employer, and he humored her cheerful protests at the way of National Socialism favored the rival metropolis of Linz. Whereas she had been able to display her culinary talents to Antonescu in a gourmet welter of oysters, mayonnaise, and caviar delicacies, with Hitler's austere meals, she was soon at her wit's end. A typical Berghoff menu was that on June 7th, 1943. Orange juice with linseed gruel, rice pudding with herb sauce, crisp bread with butter and nut paste. Hitler adored her. Mussolini sent his regrets. He would not be able to come to see him. Probably he feared to leave Italy even for a few hours. Hitler's plan was to infiltrate 4 divisions into Italy by stealth. At least 16 more were to follow under Rommel's command the moment an enemy invasion occurred. Hitler ordered the Luftwaffe to furnish anti-aircraft batteries for the Brenner Pass. If the Italians demurred, then British air raids, that's quote-unquote British air raids, were to be faked using refurbished, unexploded RAF bombs hauled out of the ruins of German cities. On June 5th, Canaris offered Brandenburg division commandos who would become members of the gun crews and so be in a position to combat any attempted sabotage on Alpine passes. Jodl's deputy warned, however, that no measure casting doubt on Italy's continued will to fight must ever become public. Admiral Canaris doubted whether their quote-unquote true objectives could be totally concealed from the Italians. To Keitel, he suggested that OKW fears of Italian defection were exaggerated, and he even persuaded the guileless field marshal to cancel the anti-sabotage provisions. He also asked for Hitler to attach an Abwehr representative to Rommel's top-secret working party. He flew to Rome. Hitler's June 1943 sojourn at the Berghof was dismal and depressing. What price victory now? Bormann brought to him a 76-page speech, which Goebbels was planning to deliver to Berlin munitions workers on the 5th. Hitler unscrewed the cap from his fountain pen and edited the script. Where Goebbels had written, quote, "When a victory is ours," unquote, Hitler thoughtfully altered the phrase to read, quote, "After this struggle is over," unquote. At the end of May, Dönitz had frankly outlined to him the catastrophic U-boat situation in the North Atlantic. In May, 38 submarines had been lost, compared with 14 in April. On one day, May 8th, 5 U-boats had been destroyed in one convoy battle, and on the 24th, Dönitz had to call off his attack on the North Atlantic altogether, fearing that he might lose his entire front line to the enemy's new radar. He still resolutely refused to believe that the British could be reading his quote-unquote unbreakable naval codes. The Germans had learned of the enemy's advances in centimetric radar after examining the remains of a bomber shot down near Rotterdam in February. Dönitz believed that the same equipment lay behind his submarine losses. Keitel instructed Canaris to find out as a matter of urgency. Hitler had long expected just this setback to the U-boats. He was surprised they had done so well so long. Thus he did not reproach the Navy. Until the acoustic homing torpedoes entered service in October as quote-unquote destroyer busters, the U-boats would therefore be restricted in their usefulness. Hitler ordered Dönitz's submarine production increased from 30 to 40 new boats a month, and he approved Dönitz's suggestion that all naval construction work be transferred to Speer's ministry. On June 15th, however, the admiral arrived at the Berghof with a staggering demand for nearly 150,000 men to implement this naval expansion. Hitler told him, quote, "I just don't have the men. The anti-aircraft and night fighter defenses have got to be increased to protect our cities. The Eastern Front has got to be strengthened. The army needs divisions for its job defending Europe," end quote. Dönitz's energy was in stark contrast to Goering's indolence and lethargy that summer. From the Gestapo morale reports, Hitler knew that his people were prey to a growing conviction that nothing could halt the enemy bombing campaign. Every night the British bombers visited a different town or city of the Ruhr and unloaded 1,000 or 2,000 tons of bombs over the streets and houses. A handful of bombers reached the Ruhr dams, unleashing the reservoirs on the sleeping populaces below. 800 foreign workers drowned in their barracks. By day, the American bomber formations completed the destruction. Sometimes the British sent small fast bomber formations or lone mosquitoes, each with a one-ton sting, would encircle for hours on end above Berlin, forcing the city's millions of inhabitants to take refuge until the all-clear sounded. Goering's solution was to propose that Germany's bombed-out citizens be evacuated to Burgundy, but in one night over 100,000 people lost their homes in Dortmund alone. Not until November was the Luftwaffe expecting to be able to strike back in force. Milch hoped to be manufacturing over 3,000 fighters and bombers every month by then. Hitler ordered bomber squadrons transferred from the west to the Mediterranean. He placed Field Marshal von Richthofen in command of the 2nd Air Force there, but even Richthofen could not prevent the huge Allied air onslaught that preceded each ground operation there. 6,000 tons of bombs were discharged over the tiny but heavily fortified island of Pantelleria. Commanding the shipping routes in the Strait of Sicily, The Italian defenders were so demoralized that they offered to capitulate without firing a shot. That the Italian soldiers had chosen not to withstand the kind of bombardment that German civilians, men, women, and children alike, were enduring night after night certainly did not augur well for the coming Mediterranean campaigns, Hitler noted. And that's the end of the chapter.